You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
It's my honor and pleasure to preside over this panel this afternoon. We had two very excellent panels this morning, and we have another good one coming. I have three professors besides me, and we all know what professors are like, so I'm going to urge them to stay inside the limit of 12 minutes. So usually if you ask a professor to introduce himself, he takes 15. The first presenter will be someone who is already known to you because he is from one of the organizations sponsoring this. He's also La Pongyo for me because he was a student at the University of Maryland some years back. And I think some of his students are around, so some of my academic grandchildren are here, in effect. Further ado, I will give the floor to Wang Kui-bo.
Thank you. Thanks again, Professor Questor, for your kind introduction without mentioning about anything I did bad at Maryland. Also, I would like to thank Richard Bush for your kind help and your great staff for making this whole thing possible. And on behalf of the chairman, Francisco Ou, of the Association of Foreign Relations back in Taipei, special thanks goes to the Mainland Affairs Council of the Republic of China for facilitating the delegation from various institutions in Taiwan. Today, my job is to have a general opening on the theme on the trilateral relations among Taipei, Washington, and Beijing. Due to the very limited time, I would like to use very simple concepts and words to describe what I have observed on the trilateral relations. First, I would like to talk about opportunities. There are one, two, and three. One, I mean, in terms of trilateral relations presented here, the first opportunity is actually, the first opportunity stems from Taiwan-Mainland-China relations. That is, can we do like this one something, respective interpretations, to seek at least temporary harmony and peace between the two sides of the Taiwan Strait? Since we have one China respective interpretations, can we have something like one Ma Xi meeting, either at APEC or some appropriate occasions with respective interpretations? What I mean here is that, yes, Ma Xi meeting can be seen as diplomatic, but why can it not be seen as cross-strait, regardless of the location? Like one China, it can be PRC. It can be ROC, depending on your definition. So Ma Xi Hui can be diplomatic, but it can be cross-strait as well, depending on your own definition. And given this downside of current cross-strait relations, I personally believe that a Ma Xi meeting, either at APEC or some other occasions, could become a major boost for cross-strait relations. It could become... and it could be very important for the solid foundation for future interactions between Taipei and Beijing. So that's one I talk about. And maybe we can do something more creative by saying one something and different interpretations between the two sides, as long as we can keep creative, keep open-minded. So maybe some problems or political barriers could be temporarily tackled by this kind of creativity. And two is two dreams. Here we have Chinese dream. Professor Tsai this morning has talked about Chinese dream. And Chinese dream for me is focused on national rejuvenation with modernization at various levels, including social, military, scientific, education, etc., etc. So will this kind of Chinese dream being appropriately realized, be able to bring some greater commonality between the ways of living in both U.S. and mainland China. And if there can be some kind of greater commonality in ways of living, then will there be some strong incentive for the two big countries to understand each other greatly? That being said, I have to mention American dreams that can actually help the two dreams coexist peacefully. American dreams, I don't want to put too much emphasis on it because most of you have known the idea of American dreams. But maybe if the Chinese dreams and American dreams, whose values or whose ways of living can converge to a certain degree, then I personally believe there could bring some hope for at least temporary peace between the two great powers. Let me talk about three. Right now we have three institutions that help stabilize cross-strait relations and Beijing-Washington relations and Taipei-Washington relations. The first institution is what I call informally formal Obama-Xi summits, which has been held last year and could be going to be held this coming November back in mainland China. This summit has been held on an equal footing, and I think they can serve as regular channels to talk about agreements and disagreements between the two great powers. I think this summit pays more attention to the contents, the issue contents, rather than formality, which could be a good thing for the interactions between Beijing and Washington. And between the two sides of the strait, President Ma has emphasized his effort for institutionalization of cross-strait relations by signing up many functional agreements with Beijing. On the other hand, I think the Beijing authority has been willing to cooperate with President Ma to help stabilize cross-strait relations in that sense. As for Taiwan and U.S., under the Taiwan Relations Act, I believe there has been a very solid, friendly interactions with mutual trust. Even though there might be some minor twists and turns, but I don't think they do any harm to the foundation of U.S.-Taiwan political or economic or social relations. So these are the 1, 2, 3 I would like to mention as big opportunities for U.S.-Taiwan-Mainland China relations in the near future. As for challenges, there are ABC. Of course, it doesn't end with C. There could be more. But because of the constraint on time, so I'm going to talk about ABC only. A is to try to keep ambiguity in politics and strategy. Ambiguity in politics and strategy. It's very important that this ambiguity has helped the stability in the Taiwan Strait and with U.S.-Mainland-China relations. But I'm not saying that we just need to keep ambiguous in our own policies towards one another, but to argue that while we keep this kind of strategic and political ambiguity, we still need to prepare for the worst scenario. Militarily, access denial carried out by the three parties could be a good idea because we cannot abandon our national defense. But access denial, not in an offensive posture, could help, you know, minimize those unwanted danger, military danger, associated with any unfortunate incidents. And in addition to access denial in military, I think in politics, we could have some sort of intention denial. Intention denial by giving clear political messages or dialogues, and by strengthening bilateral or trilateral relations politically, so that this improvement in trilateral or bilateral relations can lead to the giving up the possibility of using force against one another. So that's what I meant by intention denial in politics. So ambiguity is important, but some preparations for worst scenarios, again, is also a must. And the letter B stands for bottom-up influence. First, I would like to talk a little bit about social media and the other non-traditional ways of political communication, as they are thriving. Not only in the U.S., I believe in Taiwan and mainland China, social media might have caused some possible polarization of opinions and also caused some rapid spread of political information or rumors, which would bring greater barriers to decision makers' foreign policy decision. These social media used in such a negative way could have slowed down the capacity to make decision and act of U.S., of Taiwan, of mainland China. What is more, even more important is that I do think that the three parties all have to conquer or deal with the overwhelming interference of domestic politics in respective decision-making towards one another. For example, the U.S., bipartisan, not only in Congress, but probably in mainstream politics, has hindered U.S. decision-making towards the Asia-Pacific, or hindered the enhancement in mutual understanding between U.S. and mainland China to a certain degree. In Taiwan, of course, Taiwan also has our bipartisan, as described by Professor Xie this morning. And this bipartisan is associated with unification, independence, divergence. And meantime, we also have a president with somewhat declining approval rate, which will make his foreign policy decision even more difficult. And Taiwan, we have a stronger identity. Taiwan identity sometimes represents the unwillingness to be sided with mainland China. Sometimes. And not to mention in Taiwan, we have now what I call discontent citizens who would always like to find fault with government policies. They will never be satisfied with government policies if they don't think these policies will benefit them directly. So this kind of domestic politics kind of hindered Taiwan's policy making and policy development towards U.S. and mainland China, especially the latter. And in mainland China, we just talked about that in the previous session. So the power consolidation and anti-corruption campaign conducted by the Xi government and the national rejuvenation with probably higher nationalism, things like that would constitute these domestic politics barriers to mainland China's proper decision-making towards Taiwan and towards U.S. So that's what I call bottom-up influence. And letter C represents confidence and security building. I don't want to reiterate the importance of confidence and security building. Here, I would like to say, I would like to point out that to say this is one thing, to do this is another. So we all know the importance of confidence and security building, but in real politics, I do think there has been some insurmountable difficulty for Taiwan, for U.S., for mainland China to carry out appropriate confidence and security measures. Probably, I can argue that incrementalism between Washington and Beijing could work in terms of promoting confidence and security building. But what about incrementalism between Taipei and Beijing? Before the Sunflower Movement and some big social protests this past March and this past April, I would say yes. But right now, there seems to be a doubt in my mind that whether or not incrementalism in building up confidence and trust between Taipei and Beijing could work. If it couldn't, then do we need some, again, major boost to help build confidence and security trust between Beijing and Taipei? And what is more important is when Taipei and Beijing are conducting some sort of confidence and security building, how the region, Asia-Pacific, and the U.S. would look at it. How would the region and the U.S. would look at it? I think it depends largely on mainland China and U.S. relations, mainland China-U.S. relations, and it depends largely on mainland China and the Asia-Pacific relations in general. That is, if U.S.-mainland China relations are in good shape, then probably confidence and security building between Taipei and Beijing will not be seen as a potential threat to U.S. vital national interests. So, you know, these issues are interlinked, interrelated, and which will in turn affect Taiwan's own policy decision-making towards whether or not Taiwan should engage with confidence and security building with Beijing. And concluding remark, I have to argue that domestic politics may have largely reigned in recent development of this trilateral relationship between Taipei, Beijing, and Washington. And second, still I would like to emphasize using some creativity and flexibility will help soothe the tension among the three parties. And lastly, but not least, I cannot give you a clear answer as to where such trilateral relations would go in the future, because I personally don't see any very strong reasons or factors to be optimistic or pessimistic. So my answer would remain neutral because I still need to buy some time to see the result. Thank you very much.
Our second presenter is Professor Liu from the Department of Diplomacy at National Zhengzhou University.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and distinguished guests in this room. First of all, let me convey my gratitude to the AFR and also the CF at Brookings, led by Dr. Bush and also Dr. Huang, for making this event possible, and also to give me this opportunity to present my preliminary observation about the trilateral relationship between Beijing, Taiwan, and Washington under the name the U.S. Rebalancing Policy to Asia. And also, let me take this opportunity to thank Alan Romberg for accommodating me in this summer at the Stimson Center. Okay, it's always been a challenging work to present after lunch, so I will do my best to lower my voice. Okay, as a scholar, I need to present this purpose of research, very boring part in my research. So my presentation is actually trying to answer two questions. The first one, what is Taiwan's role in U.S. rebalancing strategy? And also, I try to figure out what Taiwan can contribute to the overall U.S. strategy to Asia in terms of maintaining peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait and across the Pacific. So here is a map. As you can see, this map is actually produced by the Center for a New American Security, and they collect all the data, including conflicts and skirmishes in East Asia after the end of the World War II. And then, as we can see, there is only one part that is across the Taiwan Strait that indicates no major conflict in recent years. This is very indicative, and I would like to encourage our knowledgeable audience to think about what makes this the case. Okay, my point would be it is always and has been very successful U.S. coercive diplomacy in Asia that make this happen. Coercive diplomacy, there are lots of literature in international relations talking about this concept. But to me, I would say it is very important to bear in mind that it is actually to make coercive diplomacy work, we need to have two things. The first one is very effective deterrence, of course. The other thing is about strategic reassurance. However, when I mention strategic reassurance, some people would argue that, okay, how do you know that you can your counterpart would reciprocate your goodwill? Then that will be very important for us also to make sure that those kind of strategic reassurance is verifiable. Okay, try to build a certain kind of mutual trust across the Taiwan Strait or between any other counterparts. We need to be sure that there are certain kind of mechanism for us to detect the intention behind the scenes. Okay, so basically I majorly borrowed this idea from Professor Thomas Christensen. I think he published a very interesting book in the year 2011. When he talked about this alliance politics, he draws our attention not only to the entrapment or abandonment issues, but also try to figure out what makes alliance politics work. Okay, and also there are some other scholars back in Taiwan. They are dealing with how to fit this Taiwan case into U.S. overall alliance politics. I think it is very noteworthy that the second one, the article published by Edward Yixing Chen, Chen Yixing Jiaoshou, in the year 2012, when he mentioned that the growing threat of China actually increases alliance cohesion between the United States and Taiwan in recent years. I think this is a very important idea at this moment. Okay, and then when it comes to U.S. pivot to Asia, I would like to argue that following the concept of coercive diplomacy, actually U.S. pivot to Asia has its own value. I don't want to bog you down with all the details about the background, the content of this rebalancing policy to Asia, because I think everyone in this room is more knowledgeable than I am talking about this issue. So I will move quick to here. I try to figure out what are the current complaints or controversies raised about this rebalancing policy of the United States. The first one is many people in the rest of the world are worrying about whether the U.S. would devote more resources in Asia, but not in their own region. So that's one thing. The second thing is I totally agree with Dr. Huang, my senior in my department. I always follow his footsteps to argue that domestic politics matter. So how the United States would try to garner support from not only in the executive branch, but also in Congress, that is very important. And the third thing is, when it comes to rebalancing, many people, especially those experts in China, they think that it is targeted at China. And a renowned scholar in China, he just published a book talking about this U.S. rebalancing and China's perception on it. He coined the term the Clinton-Campbell axis. Okay, so it explains everything. Okay, and then the last one is sometimes we would encounter, based upon the logic of alliance politics, that would be very difficult for the United States, a strong partner in that dyadic relationship, to have a say, or if not dominate, the behavior of the junior partners. So sometimes we have this at the end of the day. China Get Out, that picture is from the Philippines. Okay, when they were doing demonstrations in front of the Chinese embassy in Manila, and also the China-Japan things. And these two graphs actually indicate the fundamental question, that is the U.S.-China relationship on the above. And then I'm relatively optimistic about Taiwan's role in this U.S. rebalancing strategy. I argue that Taiwan is actually playing a contributing role to the stability and peace in East Asia under this U.S. Rebalancing strategy. First thing first, I think it is fair to argue also that Taiwan actually plays a maybe not so obvious but an indirect role in this U.S. rebalancing to Asia, because Taiwan shares the goal of peace, stability, and prosperity in Asia Pacific. That's one thing. And also, Taiwan helps to keep a relatively calm relationship across the Taiwan Strait. That's number two. But in the meantime, we also need to pay attention to that Taiwan can maybe play a relatively less role in the military part. For the past few months, we can see, the United States has continued to argue that Taiwan can play a certain role in this context. And it is very noteworthy that if we document all the official statements on U.S.-Taiwan relations lately, you can find that it's a relatively friendly environment to Taiwan. And what struck me most is, in terms of the so-called six assurances, U.S. high-level officials are more willing to mention six assurances publicly. As we can see, by public documents, Kirk Campbell in 2011, and Madeiras, March this year, and Russell, April this year. These are all very positive progress in terms of U.S.-Taiwan relations. And also, within Taiwan, the opposition party, they seem to agree that Taiwan should and play certain role under this U.S. rebalancing policy, and some of them are actually sharing many consensus with me about what kind of role of Taiwan can play. Maybe we can talk about that later in the Q&A part. And also, the perceived China threat is the key here. And then Taiwan also trying to institutionalize its relationship across the Taiwan Strait. And this, I believe, is welcomed by the United States and also in U.S. interest. In the meantime, when people are talking about the role of economic interdependence, and they seem to worry that Taiwan is economically reliant on the Chinese market. That is true, but also we need to take, because my focus is on alliance politics, so what other U.S. allies in Asia do? Actually, Korea in the year 2004, Australia 2005, and Japan, Thailand in 2007. Their number one trading partner all converted to China, except the Philippines. Right now, the number one partner for Philippines in terms of trade is Japan. And then the latest comments from State Secretary Kerry in August also praised the achievement between Taiwan and Japan on the fishery issues. So these are all positive things for Taiwan. So the most important thing to me would be how the Taiwanese government makes sure that this kind of positive things can go on and to constitute a very good cycle among the three, not only across the Taiwan Strait. Okay, so what is so important to me, I would say, we want to make sure that deterrence on the one hand and reassurance on the other hand would work together to make sure everything can go on in an order. So when it comes to this kind of trilateral relationship between China, Taiwan, and also the United States. I think management is the most important thing. So here, what U.S. and Taiwan can do is we can work together to prevent China from making willful mischaracterization. I borrowed this term from Madera's comment earlier on. And also, the other thing is, sometimes mainland China try to perceive U.S. consultation with mainland China is a sign of weakness. But I think dialogue and consultation is a way to facilitate cooperation, not a sign of weakness. So this is a very important idea. And also, some people are saying that if U.S. and China want to have better cooperation, Taiwan becomes an obstacle, especially on over the arms sales issues. So you got this. But to me, I think the U.S.-Taiwan-China relations can be looked like this. Everyone can work together. The key is not thank you for your attention, but here. Okay. How Taiwanese people perceive PRC, mainland China, right now. This is the latest survey conducted by the MAC. And as you can see, the red circle here, sorry, the numbers are really small. But as you can see, since last year, it seems that more and more Taiwanese people are perceived that China is holding certain kind of hostile views against Taiwanese government as well as Taiwanese people. Two things contributing to this outcome, I would say. One survey, different interpretations, of course. But I would say the thing is, first, Taiwan's participation in international organizations. For example, ICAO is a big thing last year. The second thing is, of course, the Sunflower Movement. Okay, I think my time is up. We can discuss in details later. Thank you very much.
Our third speaker is Richard Bush, who doesn't need any introduction with his long career and also his role as a spark plug for this event.
Thank you very much, George. I want to express my appreciation to all the other panelists. I hope I rise to their level. I want to speak at three levels. The first is the level of strategic triangle as an analytic device. The next level is the idea of power transition, also as an analytic device. And the third is very concrete. It's about the 2016 election and what that does to relations among Beijing, Washington, and Taipei. So first, level one, strategic triangles. If we think broadly and somewhat abstractly about the interaction about among different sides of the triangle, a number of possibilities come to mind with respect to Beijing, Taipei, and Washington. Some of these are actually things we've seen in history. The first, and this is in no particular order, the first would be that one party, and Washington is the one that comes to mind, mediates between Beijing and Taipei. And actually, this a version of this happened back in the 1940s when the United States, under George Marshall, tried to mediate between the Kuomintang and the CCP, and that effort failed, and that has forever given us an allergy to mediating in the future. And actually, it's U.S. policy that we will not mediate. The second is that the United States basically decides to pull out of this three-way interaction or to reduce its role in a rather fundamental way. And this also actually happened in the past. And thinking of late 1949, 1950 to June 25th, when President Truman and Secretary Acheson basically said, we're out of here. We're going to leave Taiwan to its fate, and that will have strategic consequences for us, but we don't see that we can affect the outcome. And fortunately for Taiwan, Kim Il-sung invaded South Korea, and the rest is history. A third possible option is that the United States and Taiwan combine to balance against China. And that was what we saw from the 1950s through the 1960s until Kissinger and Nixon. And you can see hints of this in discussions of rebalancing. I think Professor Liu had a much more nuanced treatment of the topic. Fourth is the United States and China combine in some way to impose an outcome on Taiwan without it having a voice, or to create circumstances where Taiwan has no choice. Some believe that this was the possible or likely result of the PRC-U.S. normalization from 1972 to 1979, even if it wasn't the intention of that process. I think given Taiwan's democratic system, such a scenario is now highly unlikely, if not impossible. There's some other possibilities that are somewhat more abstract. One is that Taiwan and the mainland combine to balance against the United States. There's a sort of way that the Chinese dream could go that would give you that result. The constant nightmare of the United States and Taiwan is another option, and that is the PRC seeks to solve this dispute and therefore transform the triangle by using force against Taiwan. And so Washington has to decide what to do. I think it's been a key aspect of U.S.-China relations, U.S.-Taiwan relations, of how to deter against that scenario. And I think it's no more important today than it was in the past. There are a couple of scenarios that describe recent events. One is that Taiwan, through political means, tries to move in the direction of de jure independence, or is perceived to be doing that, and thus pose a challenge to both mainland and American interests, and also transform the triangle. And that is one narrative about what happened between around 1995 to 2008. Another and my final scenario is that Taiwan and the mainland seek to stabilize their relationship economically and perhaps politically, and that reduces the pressure on the United States to be directly and regularly involved in cross-strait relations, although we still have an interest. Doesn't mean you're going to move automatically to try to resolve the fundamental dispute, but it's certainly different than some of the other things. Now, there are lots of other scenarios, I suppose. My point is that which pattern we see in real life depends on the intentions of each government, how much each government perceives or misperceives the actions of the others, strategy that each pursues to protect its interests and advance its goals, the capabilities that each brings to the contingency, and so on. Now, I think that in the current situation we have, and given Beijing's long-term goals, makes sense for Taiwan to position itself in the triangle so that it does three things. First of all, reassure Beijing about its intentions. Number two, strengthen itself so it doesn't have to negotiate from a situation of weakness. And third, maintain good relations with the United States and pursue objectives that are congruent with American interests. So that's level one. Let me move to level two. I guess the point of departure is to note that we could talk about a lot of strategic triangles in Asia, and sorting them out is all is very difficult. This particular one may not be the most salient, so maybe it's not a good mechanism for analysis. So maybe power transitions is a better one. And you know the thinking behind this, that China's relative power is growing, U.S. relative power is in some decline, and the fear that animates a lot of strategic thinking today is that rapid power transitions lead to war. That's fear is what's behind China's concept of the new pattern of great power relations. This fear is most appropriate in East Asia, and that's where China's challenge to U.S. hegemony is most likely. Now, scholars and pundits think about power transitions in terms of material power. I think what's also important is the interactions that have occurred and will occur between the United States and China on a number of specific points of tension, for good or ill. The lessons learned in each of these areas in a cumulative way will inform the conclusions that both the rising power, China, and the challenge power, the United States, reach about the other's long-term intentions and how the other will act in the future. Third parties will also draw their own conclusions. So, relations between the United States and China are likely to be marked by a series of specific test cases where interests collide and where frictions are likely. And if frictions predominate, then the conclusions drawn in a general way will be negative. This list of test cases is not short. It includes North Korea, East China Sea, South China Sea, Iran's nuclear program, how to respond to the Arab Spring, Afghanistan, the future of Pakistan, cybersecurity, the global economy, climate change, and so on, and Taiwan's another one. Particularly in Chinese perceptions, Taiwan has been an integral part of the U.S. effort to contain, constrain, or disrupt China's rise. Material power is certainly at play, but Taiwan is the issue on which mutual U.S. PRC learning has been the longest and the most intense. And for China especially, the lessons that it has drawn from this interaction have been negative. And the conventional lesson is that Americans have used Taiwan to check and contain China's rise. I don't believe that, but my views don't matter. Now, an important point here is that Taiwan may have been a passive actor in this, but it is not a passive actor anymore. It's been an active participant in the last two decades. It doesn't determine the conclusions that Washington and Beijing come to, but it shapes them through its actions. And American and Chinese views tended in one direction from the early 90s until 2008, and then it moved in a somewhat different direction then. The question before us is how these shaping of these conclusions will evolve in the future and what Taiwan might do to shape them. I think that for the next couple of years, cross-strait relations are basically stalled, and we've had a lot of discussion about why that's the case. I think it's worth noting that Taiwan can have an impact on issues other than cross-strait relations in which the United States and China interact. I think President Ma's East China Peace Initiative is one of those. The agreement that was reached between Taiwan and Japan on fisheries is part of this picture. And it sets an example that others, particularly China, can emulate. So let me go to level three, which is my most concrete and least abstract, and that's the 2016 election. It could change the role that Taiwan plays in US-PRC interaction. It could alter the nature of the US-China-Taiwan triangle. Whether it does or not will depend on which party wins the presidency, the politics, the policies that the new president will pursue, the state of executive legislative relations, and the public mood. How am I doing? I think it's way too early to predict the results of the 2016 election. Current polls are probably pretty meaningless. The outcome will depend on factors that cannot accurately be judged at the current time. These include the quality of each of the candidates, the ability of each camp to raise money, the effectiveness of each campaign in energizing its core support and attracting swing voters, and the relative salience of various policy issues. And the Kuomintang and the DPP have different strengths in these areas. I think the key variable will come down to which camp is better in controlling the agenda. Now, we've discussed whether the DPP will somehow alter its approach to the mainland, and I think in the interest of time, I'll skip over that. And it's hard to say anyway, so I won't spend time speculating. What I am prepared to say with some confidence is that the U.S. government at some time and in some way will express itself on the implications of the 2016 election for U.S. interests. Now, I recognize, because I lived this at one time, that Washington is caught in a bit of a dilemma here. On the one hand, we have a general principle that it's the voters of friendly democratic countries who should be the ones to pick their leaders at the ballot box, and that the United States should not try to influence their votes by expressing a preference for one candidate or the other. On the other hand, the United States does have interests in the policies of any elected leadership, whether it's Taiwan or a lot of other places. So, in spite of this dilemma, Washington has not been quiet. And let me just give you a few examples. 1996, the Clinton administration, through its actions, made a statement of sorts. December 1999, I myself made a public statement in Taiwan where I sort of laid out both sides of our view about Taiwan's democratic election. Almost exactly 4 years later, another person named Bush made his statement, and that was clearly critical of Chen Shui-bian's policies. In September 2007, actually 7 years ago yesterday, my friend Tom Christensen made a long and detailed critique of China administration's policies and the DPP's strategy for the 2008 election. Almost exactly 4 years later, September 2011, the Obama administration conveyed its views through the Financial Times. So this is something we do. We feel there's a need for us to express our views on how our interests will be affected by Taiwan's elections. And to say nothing, which some in Taiwan might want us to do, is actually to make a statement as well. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Our fourth speaker is Professor Min Yer at Boston University, and she's the director of the East Asian Studies Program in the Frederick Pardee School of Global Studies. She has a book coming out with an absolutely fascinating title, Diasporas and Foreign Direct Investment in China and India, published by Cambridge University Press this year. So, floor is yours.
Well, thank you so much. I really want to thank Dr. Bush for inviting me to this occasion. This is a great break from my hectic household and from my work at BU. but I do feel a little bit uneasy sitting here and talking to the real experts on Taiwan. My research area is really outside of Taiwan. But in two books that I published, The Making of Northeast Asia and these Diasporas and FDI in China and India, Taiwan featured heavily. So I think I feel I'm quite compelled to offer my observation here. But these observations may just be impractical and unrealistic and perhaps irresponsible. But my heart is at the right place. I mean well. So the first I want to, I feel that the Taiwan issue and the cross-strait relationship or the triangular relationship are thoroughly studied and discussed in security identity politics, party politics, electoral politics. I feel like the development issues have been forgotten or haven't been paid more attention. And this has led to two dangerous tendencies, in my view. The first tendency that I see is that what I call a deafening developmental defeatism in Taiwan. I'll explain. Again, it's not based on thorough research. It's more from interactions with residents of Taiwan and reading the surveys of Sunflower Movements. And also, sometimes I feel the government of the Taiwan has the same tendency, that they feel that in interacting with the mainland in economic terms, Taiwan would lose out no matter what. And Taiwan's economic future is not bright. So that's what I call development defeatism. And I want to argue this is just not true. Taiwan is a very successful economy, and this actually I'm quite confident because I my PhD degree from Princeton, I researched, actually learned all these great accomplishments in Taiwan, the 1950s to 1970s, labor intensive manufacturing. Think about Taiwan, really in a very bad state, and yet becoming the major manufacturer and exporter. 1980s to 1990s, in the high-tech sectors, Taiwan was again a successor, a very successful case in East Asia. And then in the recent 10 years, I'm just amazed by how much progress that Taiwan achieved in public health, social developments, environmental protection, all those challenges from later development that currently China is struggling with, and India and other developing countries and the emerging markets are all struggling with, and South Korea is still struggling, but Taiwan has accomplished a great deal. So by relating to this history, I just feel Taiwan, if we put the development together or the development first vision, then Taiwan has very bright economic future. And it should be the Taiwan's economic development prospect, in my views, are brighter than perhaps in China. The second tendency I feel is in the mainland. The sense that I call a sense of favoritism on the mainland part, again, not based on public surveys, just in speaking to people on the mainland and online web writings, the mainlanders feel that they are doing Taiwan a favor by signing ACFA, by signing service treaty, by sending all these investments or purchasing orders to Taiwan. And I think this is quite dangerous because once you have this, I'm doing you a favor, and then you do not appreciate. So this leads to the disillusionment, I feel, on the mainland part. So the public in the beginning, they supported the favor, and then later they become quite disillusioned. And this leads to a widening perception gap between the two sides of the Taiwan. And to the mainlanders, my reaction is, again, this actually is based on serious research, that Taiwan has contributed significantly to the mainland industrialization, globalization, and high-tech developments from the 1980s to the current period. So it's the mainland that owes greater recognition of Taiwan's contribution rather than this kind of I'm doing a favor posture. Besides, I think if we compare, look at the strengths in Taiwan's economy, economic exchange across strait would be very beneficial to the mainland. I actually forgot to mention one point on the defeatism side. I think a part of the reason that Taiwan has this development defeatism is the scare strategy that's been employed by both parties and this is outrageous accusation, but I do feel both the KMT or the DPP, the KMT in promoting deepening economic exchange is giving the message that if the voters do not elect the KMT, then Taiwan would be just so worse off because the relationship with the mainland is so critical, so important to the Taiwan's development future. And DPP, on the other hand, scare the voters. If you vote for engagement exchange with the mainland, then you'll be engulfed by the mainland's power. Both rhetorics entirely different, but the messages are quite the same. So I think it's kind of scare strategy they are trying to paint to the voters. But this enhances the sense of insecurity among the public. Then moving forward, what can we do? Again, quite impractical suggestions, I think. But from the U.S. point of view, this may be my wish list, okay? So from the United States, I think as an opinion leader, the U.S.-based specialists should encourage and help Taiwan form a new development vision and to shift or diversify the discourse on Taiwan affairs. So there should be a serious study of Taiwan's development again, and thinking Taiwan not as a trouble, but an asset for later development. Second, I think the United States should support Taiwan's independent development by opening its market further to Taiwan and transferring technology. And lastly, I think in the bilateral negotiations in the region, Taiwan should be included. At a collective level, this enhances Taiwan's development discourse and visions for the next next stage. In Taiwan, I think the government or the parties or the elite should reorient its priority from politics to development and shape the dominant discourses on the island from independence versus unification to how to grow Taiwan in the next decades. Today in the morning panel, the discussion was on China dream. But in fact, in China, there's another document that's also quite important. It's China 2030, put together by the World Bank and Li Keqiang, who is the premier of China. And maybe Taiwan is not Taiwan 2030, but perhaps a vision of sorts, like Taiwan 2020. Expecting what Taiwan wants to accomplish in 2020. So I think this will, when you focus on the development first, Taiwan first, then the discourse will change from how to deal with the mainland to how mainland feature in Taiwan's the vision. And this will foster other ties in the region. It may be very difficult to do. I'm not sure that the ruling parties are willing to make this shift, but the party that succeeds in leading this dialogue, leading this discourse, may capture the mainstream voters in the island, because I think residents of Taiwan share the interest in a prosperous and quite a well-developed Taiwan. Then the third actor, of course, is the mainland. But I think if Taiwan's government plays it well, the mainland would welcome the shift. Right? Independent development sounds much better than independence movement. So facing the backlashes from the Taiwan society, facing the backlashes of the independence movement, the mainland, that might be quite susceptible to these moves in relation to Taiwan's development. But on the other hand, I think the mainland policy should focus on the social aspects rather than I give you the benefits, I give you the material investments, the material welfare. Instead, should focus on repairing social gap there, across streets. And the first step, I think, is to recognize Taiwan's past and current contribution to the mainland more fully, and recognize that Taiwan has made great contribution to the mainland's development success. The second is to revive and strengthen those grassroots social organizations, the hometown associations, the Taiwan Affairs offices at the grassroots level, because in the 80s and the 90s, those were actually very important in receiving, encouraging Taiwan's investments and manufacturing industries on the mainland. Now perhaps those can serve on the one hand as a social channels, on the other may channel some of the real private investors from the mainland to Taiwan, rather than the heavy-handed local government's buying spree that we are seeing that the Taiwan public is really resisting. Well, I will end here, and I welcome criticism.
Let me congratulate the panel. I think it is, again, very good. I feel I personally learned an awful lot by being here right through the day. I do have a personal list of open questions, questions that I think that were raised, but I think many of you might agree with me, can be probed further and aren't settled yet. I'll run them by you and then go to your questions from the floor. First one is a big one of how central is Taiwan and to American policy and to our own relations with China. And Richard Bush made a very plausible list of issues that can come up between us and China that don't relate directly to Taiwan at all. On the other hand, I know some people who say if it weren't for Taiwan, our ability to cooperate with China and all these other issues would be much greater, that this is sort of the catalyst for a lot of back and forth about why do the Chinese not restrain arms sales to a country like Iran, for example. Douglas Powell this morning made the case that there isn't that much concern around Washington with the Taiwan issue at the moment, and that we're concerned with many, many other things. And what does that mean in terms of our relations with China? But whether what we're talking about here is really central to American foreign policy, whether American foreign policy is centrally involved in this is one open question. A second one that was raised well by Wang Kuibo and raised several times this morning is the role of other issues on Taiwan besides relations with the mainland. What really determines who's going to win the next election? What really determines the approval ratings for President Ma or any other incumbent in Taiwan? It's often issues of corruption. It's often issues of efficiency. Who did the best job on the last typhoon? And that's something we can probe some more. That says, does the average person in Taiwan each morning say, how are we doing vis-a-vis the mainland? Or is that sort of low on his list of concerns? There's a reflective issue of that. It says, what does came up in the last panel, the second panel, on what about people in China, which aren't facing an election each 4 years, but themselves have an agenda, and how is that agenda changing, and how much of that is related to the future of Taiwan, or how much of that is related to many, many other issues? A third open question, very well addressed by Professor Ye just now, is the role of economics. I've always personally believed that economics is a great help here, that letting people in Taiwan get richer and letting people in the mainland get richer, and they do it cooperatively by trade, sort of eases a lot of other concerns and builds bridges. But there is a counter, which we see all around us, that says no one is ready to celebrate what they just got. They're always ready to say, what have you done for me lately? And I'll give a personal note. I can remember immediately after the introduction of the Deutschmark in Germany, getting letters from my German aunt complaining about the way the Deutschmark was affecting her. And my reaction in retrospect is to say this is one of the greatest things that ever happened to Germany, ever happened to Europe, and sort of the freeing up of trade that came with that. And the European Union and North American free trade areas have all been great, except everyone's grumbling about it. Union's not alone in grumbling about it. A vivid demonstration now in Taiwan of people saying, hey, we're not doing so well because we're trading with the mainland. The sheer data of the number of people from Taiwan going to the mainland to do business, I always find fascinatingly positive. But there's this undercurrent of saying, oh, is it really as positive as it should be? Now, next kind of issue on my list is sort of ethnic feeling. We've heard the polls several times cited through the morning about what's your long-term preference, the status quo or this or that. There used to be another poll, I think that still exists. I would love to see the current data on how do you rate yourself? Are you Taiwanese, are you Chinese, are you both? And that used to swing back and forth. Whenever there were missile threats from the mainland, a whole lot of people in Taiwan would no longer say, I'm Chinese. They would say, I'm only Taiwanese. And as soon as the missile threats ended, they would swing back to saying, I'm both. And a fair number of people saying, I'm Chinese. I'm not Taiwanese. I'm just Chinese. And that relates to what a associate of mine who's at Beida has described as what he fears about nationalism in East Asia, that Chinese, young Chinese feeling very nationalistic, young Japanese, young Koreans feeling very nationalistic, and how will that all play? And his vision is that reminds him of Europe before 1914, and that there aren't all the institutions that have been created since 1945 to get people past this. But how this affects Taiwan, I find interesting. One of the papers noted contribution of Taiwan to easing tensions or easing disputes about fisheries with Japan. There was a time where the Kuomintang was ready to play the one China card big time by supporting the mainland's claims to the South China Sea and supporting the mainland's claims to Diaoyutai and so on. And I'm curious what's happened there. It used to be not just the Kuomintang, but the ROC military was ready to beat the one China drum. I think Richard Bush can correct me if I'm wrong. There was one point that Taiwan is actually talking about sending reinforcements to help the PLA in case there's a dust-up with the Philippines about the islands in the South China Sea. And I think we put some pressure on to talk the ROC military out of that, saying that's going a little bit too far to show unity with the mainland. But the point I would raise is that being a go-between between China and Japan may be very useful from our humane points of view, from an American point of view. Is it necessarily optimal in terms of building bridges with the rest of China, given all that we see all the time about resurgences of Japanese forgetfulness about World War II and the indignation that tends to produce all around East Asia? But these are my personal list of questions, which I'll throw out. They don't take priority. I'm going to leave them simmering here. And it's now my role to shut up and take names of people who want to raise questions. Yes, sir, right here.
Scott Harold from RAND. Two questions, one for Huang Guibo, George Custer, and Yemin, and then one for Richard. There's a lot of description just now of people who are not happy with the government in Taiwan or with trade and economic relations with the mainland as people who really just don't understand how much this is benefiting them or people who are just always going to complain no matter what. This is the common portrayal of anti-trade people as ignorant. I just wonder, it strikes me as rather, pardon the term, but a rather arrogant description. I suspect a lot of these people know what they're talking about. It's their jobs on the line. But maybe I'm wrong. But I guess I'd really like to push. Yemin was very democratic in saying, you know, push me, criticize me if this description is not right. It just struck me as a little bit too simplistic to just paint these people as fools who don't know what the real story is. Richard, when it comes to the mainland, we have no problem here in the United States talking about human rights problems or criticizing governance. But we don't really do that very much with Taiwan today. But you were very active in doing that in the early 1980s when Taiwan was a very authoritarian society. And there's been a lot of criticism of Taiwan now under the Ma administration for politicization of the judiciary, for the consolidation of the media under the control of large corporations that are heavily invested in the mainland. And as you know from Hong Kong, this is an enormous vector by which the mainland tries to influence the development of society in Hong Kong. It's also suspected of trying to do that in Taiwan, where there has also been a heavy reliance on organized criminal elements, and most notably Chang'anle, the white wolf, who's come back from the mainland, and who the Taiwan government has dropped all charges against, and he's now parading around and intimidating democratic protesters. So I wonder if the picture of U.S.-Taiwan relations under the Ma administration, while largely shaped in the D.C. mindset through a positive narrative about the reduction in the possibility of cross-strait war, which is good for the U.S., which is focused on Middle East and other areas, is in any way being undermined, eroded by failures of governance by the Ma administration and or a movement in a somewhat more authoritarian or autocratic direction?
Why don't we, for a moment, do one question at a time, and then when we get short, we'll group the questions. So there's a question about economics and about is democracy imperfect on Taiwan. So.
Well, thank you for criticizing me. this gives me opportunity to clarify my position. I do not claim that everything is fine in Taiwan for everybody. I have no such knowledge, and I don't think that there is anybody has this such knowledge. Precisely for the reason that we haven't seen good empirical research, like what kind of investments have come to Taiwan, what impacts, what are the sectoral impacts, what are the group impacts. And I was encouraging Professor Lu, who is in Taiwan, to find some good, even just a locality or even some group of people to figure out exactly how these the exchange is affecting people. And what I argue is a switch of priority. If the ruling parties can focus on development, focus on the public's development, their well-being, and incorporate real research, real evidence in their strategy, and then craft Taiwan 2020. And if there are negative impacts, then address them. But I also argue that the defeatism is unwarranted because Taiwan has a capacity to do much better if there are downsides.
Thanks a lot for your question, Scott. I think President Ma would probably find your remark about Taiwan becoming more autocratic highly amusing, because I suspect that he feels like he's the least powerful person on the island in terms of being able to push his agenda forward. One cannot dispute these things happening, but I have the strong impression that Taiwan remains a very lively democratic system. I have not been shy about sort of describing the problems in Taiwan's political system and my belief that that system is not serving well the people it's supposed to serve, and my belief that unless that system is reformed, it will be very difficult for Taiwan to do a lot of the tasks that it needs to do for its own survival. I think you target a very important point, and one that we shouldn't lose sight of. Thanks.
David.
I wanted to pick up on your question, George. How important is the Taiwan issue? I'm looking at the testimony of Assistant Secretary Danny Russell, April 3rd, 2014, to the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, and he answers that question. And I wondered if our two Taiwan panelists could respond to how they interpret what he meant. And then I'd be interested in what Richard had to say. The operative sentence is in the second paragraph. Strengthening our relations with Taiwan and our longstanding friendship with the people of Taiwan remains a key element of the U.S. strategic rebalance to Asia. So I just wonder how people understand that statement.
Okay. If you ask me the question whether Taiwan is central to U.S. policy towards Asia, you know, my answer would be unfair because I'm from Taiwan. And my answer would be unfair because I'm from Taiwan. So I would definitely say yes. But the fact is, yes, Taiwan is important for U.S. Asia-Pacific policy. I tend to argue that Taiwan cannot participate physically in U.S. rebalancing in Asia strategy. But in many, many other ways, implicitly, Taiwan has been very helpful for the U.S. To conduct such a rebalancing strategy in this region. As I presented just now, sometimes ambiguity keeps things, you know, more harmonious. So I think Daniel Russell's statement indicated that the U.S. does take Taiwan seriously, but how would U.S. incorporate Taiwan into its rebalancing strategy? I think maybe we cannot tell that from the wording, but the deeds. So I think that probably the next round of arms sale to Taiwan and the continued support from the U.S. for Taiwan's greater international space, etc., would mean something. And that would indicate the significance of Taiwan in U.S. policy towards Asia.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lampton, for your question. I think for that comment made by Dan Russell, I think it is really important, and it is, to my knowledge, it's welcomed by most people in Taiwan, including the opposition party. And to me, I would say the six assurances, those points are very important, and also it is very important to acknowledge that people-to-people exchanges between the United States and Taiwan are quite important as well. Thank you.
I confess that I'm not exactly sure what Danny meant, but let me have a try. I think that Taiwan is, first of all, a quiet beneficiary of rebalancing. Frankly, I don't think the rebalancing is that new. I think it is an adjustment in a very long-standing policy of the United States towards East Asia, and the adjustments have been required all along to take account of new circumstances, and we do have new circumstances. But I think a United States that is deeply involved and active in the affairs of East Asia is good for Taiwan. And our emphasis on the necessity of preserving peace and security in the Western Pacific is beneficial to Taiwan. I also think that Taiwan is a quiet contributor to the rebalancing policy in the sense that when it and the mainland together manage cross-strait relations well, this is a boon for the United States because it removes one item on the list of things we have to worry about as much. We don't have to engage in dual deterrence with Beijing and Taipei if Taipei and Beijing are doing a good job managing their own relations. And as I said, there are cases where the actions that the ROC has taken on other issues also contribute to our objectives. I think the agreement between Taiwan and Japan on fisheries is actually quite significant because it targeted the most immediate danger or the most immediate and proximate trigger for some kind of conflict between Taiwan and Japan. And it, once you remove that trigger or disable that trigger, it makes it a whole lot easier to manage larger issues. And would that the parties to some of the other maritime issues in East Asia took that kind of approach? Thanks.
I think we have about 15 minutes left, so we'll group some questions now and then have the panel answer them. Yes, sir.
This is not really a criticism or comment or something, just a clarification. And actually, I have argued in my own studies previously, and that the when we try to look at the Taiwan's mainland China policy, we can see this as kind of a policy making in a two dimension, which is space. Two dimensions include one is the national identity, independence versus unification, and so on. This will affect how people see how to deal with China. But on the other hand, there's also another dimension that is, I call it, say, economic interest versus security concern. And for many people in Taiwan, actually, that's probably quite at least imagined or real, and that the too much dependence on the Chinese market will hurt Taiwan's security. So I think that's a very important concern for a lot of people. So so when we see people debates about whether they should go to the to utilize fully the Chinese market and so on, this is also something in mind for many voters in Taiwan. Of course, you can see that these two dimensions oftentimes can collapse into only one, because most likely for people on the independent side, they are very much concerned about security. For those people on the unification side, they think, okay, to do business with China. So actually, I have looked at the survey data and so on. I do see that there's this kind of tendency over there. So I think for many people in Taiwan, they know what they're talking about. And this is really about the trade-off between economic interest on the one hand and national security on the other.
Right over here.
Good afternoon. Lieutenant Colonel Scott McDonald, the Strategic Initiatives Group at the headquarters, U.S. Marine Corps. As many of the panel alluded to and some of the questions have stated, we have a hard time understanding each other. PRC can't understand what Taiwan or the U.S. is saying. U.S. can't understand what PRC or Taiwan is saying. Hell, we even have trouble sometimes figuring out what we're saying. Given all that and how much that leads to the chance of misperceptions, has the time for strategic ambiguity passed? Are we not making ourselves less secure by hiding what we're going to do in given situations? Thank you.
One dimension that has not been quite discussed, which I'm curious about, is the domestic political development of Taiwan, on the impact of which on China, on mainland China itself. I know that it's hard to discuss, I mean, to kind of study the public opinion in China, on mainland China, over about Taiwan. I don't recall that, Professor Liu, you had that, you know, survey of Taiwanese, look at how they look at mainland, but I think the reverse is not quite, at least not studied. It's probably difficult. But what's interesting is, as I observed, I mean, this is not unscientific, in recent years, as the rise of emergence of social media in China, there is also that some Taiwanese politicians now open Weibo on Chinese Weibo, and which is very interesting. There are two events I thought in recent years had some sort of impact on Chinese public opinion over how they look at Taiwan. The first one is 2012 election, that when President Ma Ying-jeou made that speech, I mean, actual campaigning, was actually live covered online. Mm-hmm. So a lot of mainlanders saw that. And what they were actually had quite some impact. I saw that, I mean, I look at that, I followed it a little bit, and they quite positive. They look at this democracy at work, if you will. Because it's the first sort of, this is sort of bastion of a democracy in a Chinese cultural world. And they look at that lens now. The second event is the Sunflower Movement. When it started out as occupation of the legislative yuan, it's actually kind of, I know that as a result, destroy some sort of a damage some image of as a consolidated democracy, a procedural democracy in the eyes of some mainland Chinese, including some public intellectuals. So those two events, which is, you know, now, of course, it's not scientific, but I observe that it's some sort of impact. So I wonder if our Taiwanese scholar sort of have some views on that, that domestic political development of Taiwan on mainland. Of course, and now we know even Hong Kong, the Sunflower Movement has some impact on, in Hong Kong as well.
Get about two or three more questions and then let our panelists respond. So over here.
I'm Zhiqin. I'm from Taiwan. I'm from University of Maryland, sociology. I have a question for when Taiwan is dealing with a country like China, where the massive capital is owned by the state, you can never really separate economic development from political influence, just like we saw in Hong Kong and also in United Corporation in China, which is a Chinese corporation. They have massive economic tie with the Chinese government. And what happens when you only think about economic development, but while Chinese government can still influence their political powers through economic power? How do you deal with that? How does Taiwanese people deal with that? And also, regarding to what Professor Ye was just talking about, the defeatism, I don't think that's really true, because economic development is not just a singular numerical number. It's also about who earns that money. And sometimes people, a lot of people go to China, but a lot of other people who cannot go to China, who cannot earn that money. What do we do with these people? These people are about 70-something percent of Taiwanese employment. And what do we do with these people? Especially with the service trade agreement, mostly the financial, the banking sector, the real estate sector, they are the one earning money, and they are already rich. What do we do with those people who do not enjoy those economic development? Thank you.
Okay, we'll take one more and then let the panel respond. So, right back there.
Hi, I'm Peter. I'm the second year master's student from the LS School, George Washington University. I just have a quick question. So I was wondering how the U.S. should keep a balance between its arms sales to Taiwan and its, if I can say so, aggressive or active military behavior around China, because last August we know that a dangerous air encounter happened in South China Sea, and I think this might affect Ms. Susan Rice's mission to China for paving the path to the potential Obama-Xi meeting. Thank you, because I think Taiwan plays a really important role in U.S. pivot to China, and it needs to enhance ability for self-defense. Thank you very much.
Okay. What I'll do is start with Professor Ye, and we'll just move along here.
Okay. Well, I as I said, my observations are not mainstream. So from the questions, it also shows. What I argue, I'm not doing advocacy. So there are a couple of things I think are indicated in the questions. One is belief. You believe, and then advocacy. I'm not doing this. But I think I ask for a change in discourse and a serious research on Taiwan's development. And the second, what we call disclaimer, that I'm not advocating for deepening economic ties between Taiwan and the mainland. I'm not advocating for the service trade agreement, and neither I'm against it. What I argue is independent development of Taiwan. So the discourse and research on the real independent Taiwan development, just to separate the idea of Taiwan's development from economic exchange with the mainland. I think that tie is just so dominant in any discussions of development. So it's like if you talk about development, it's about relationship with the mainland. That's not the case. And appreciate your comments. But I think I welcome your interest in this topic, and I hope you do, you know, serious research and then find out exactly what would be the Taiwan general public interest, and make a comment based on not based on belief, but based on research. And the second point is, again, based on research. We all know we are all scared of state-owned enterprise, but are there serious research showing that SOEs are coming to Taiwan? I don't think so. And also in China, it's really SOEs are the pillar industries, but they are not the dominant economic actors in the mainland. If there will be investments, it would be investments from the small investors from Zhejiang, these localities that have lots of social connections with Taiwan, have lots of complementarities with Taiwan. And when they come, welcome. Otherwise, you know, the Taiwan has the right to decide what kind of investors you want to come. But do not just equalize China's investors with SOEs. The SOEs are not the main economic actors in China.
Okay, I can take very quickly on Professor Liu's question. I think the Sunflower Movement or the overall political development in Taiwan is playing a certain kind of positive role on China. As I recall, 6 months ago, many of my students, they were sitting in front of the Legislative Yuan. At that time, it seems to me that they have developed certain kind of ABC mentality, anything but China. They can accept those kind of things, but just not coming from China. But later on, I figure out that they tend to think about their own future. And many of them are trying to figure out the answers by themselves. This is a new great step forward for the younger generation back in Taiwan nowadays. So I would say toward the end of this year, I think the big election will be a very notable a benchmark for Taiwan's democracy, because this younger generation, many of them would have their first vote in their life. So let's see. Thank you.
Well, last two comments come appropriately from management, so they can respond to the questions and also say what else we're saying here.
Okay, I'll go first. Just briefly to Professor Liu's question about Taiwan domestic politics and its impact on mainland China. Let me say it this way. We used to say that Taiwan can act as a beacon of democracy for mainland China's political future, but I would say that probably before, Taiwan was seen as a beacon of democracy for mainland China remotely, looking from a remote distance. But nowadays, I would argue Taiwan is still a beacon for mainland China democracy, but with a close look. So now mainland Chinese people would think that, okay, maybe Taiwan's democracy is not that perfect, but still it can serve as a beacon for us. At least we can move to that direction to make our political system better. So that's my personal understanding about that. But also, based on my contacts with my mainland Chinese friends, I think some of them still appreciate Taiwan's democracy, while others would feel worried about Taiwan's democracy, and dare not use the so-called Taiwan model to mainland China. And the question about the possible political and economic influence exercised by mainland China in its interaction with Taiwan, the only thing I can say that to my best understanding, the Ma'ingeo administration, of course, knows the associated opportunities and dangers when dealing with mainland China politically and economically. But it's unrealistic to argue that Taiwan shouldn't deal with mainland China if there is some political risks. Here is what we in Taiwan are doing. That is, we try to diversify our engagements with mainland China and other countries. So On the one hand, we must face mainland China. We must do business with mainland China. And for peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait, we have to deal with mainland China politically. But on the other hand, we need to approach the other countries under the pressure of Beijing to talk about further economic cooperation, to talk about further people-to-people exchanges, to make Taiwan as a hub of something important in the region of Asia that can guarantee Taiwan's safety once there is some obvious disagreement between Taiwan and mainland China in the future. So it's very an easy task for any leaders in Taiwan to face such a rising mainland China and such an urgent need from Taiwan's people to walk out to touch the world by engaging more international activities, by participating in more international organizations. You know, very difficult, but I just can tell you that I believe that no Taiwanese leaders would downgrade the possible dangers if mainland China doesn't abandon its use of force against Taiwan.
First of all, Xiaobo, I thought you were answering your own question, and it's a two-part answer. Number one, what mainland people think about Taiwan's political system depends on which part of the political system they're looking at. You know, if you're looking at the electoral system, that actually works pretty good to register public sentiment. Another thing that happened in Taiwan that was approved very positively on the mainland was Tsai Ing-wen's concession speech at the election, and which is reflects a mentality that's very different from "you live, I die." This is an issue that is highly contested within the PRC political system. The regime has an interest in emphasizing the negative attributes of Taiwan's political system, and others have an interest in emphasizing the positive, and we know who's winning. Colonel McDonald, on strategic ambiguity, I think that bumper sticker, and that's all it is passé. I would say methodologically, first of all, a lot of the analysis of this is based on public statements of the U.S. government, but and not on all the private things that are said diplomatically about our intentions in a crisis situation. I think the real test of whether our declaratory policy is ambiguous is what the PLA thinks we do. Do they have any sense of ambiguity about our intentions? And I think you can see from the way that they have built capabilities and exercised their forces and developed doctrine, they have no question that we would intervene in a Taiwan contingency. Actually, they may be more certain about our intervention than we are. On the question about Taiwan arms sales and our surveillance activities, I think that these stem from the same source. They are responses to a complex of actions by the PRC side. For over 20 years, for over 15 years, the PLA is building up its capabilities to deter independence and maybe at some point have the ability to compel unification. It is very important for us to know in detail about the development of those capabilities and how they are being used at the current time to give us a better sense of what PLA activities are. We do this in international waters and international airspace, where we believe very strongly we have the right to be. We believe and assume that there are good ways for the target of that surveillance to respond to our activities and our presence. We get very concerned when those norms are not being followed. The The arms sales part of this is that China's buildup of capabilities, even as Taiwan is pursuing a policy that includes reassurance to China about its intentions and a desire to improve cross-state relations, creates or continues a sense of vulnerability in Taiwan. Now, why is China continuing to build up even as Taiwan has tried to take a peaceful and responsible approach? And as a result of that ambiguity, as a result of that vulnerability, we then get requests from Taiwan for help in the form of arms sales to improve their deterrent capabilities and to reduce the risk that Beijing might actually use those capabilities against Taiwan. As was suggested this morning, we haven't seen the last of the arms sales decisions that will occur. But you know, the source is ultimately in China. Thank you very much.
Well, my schedule says closing remarks are coming now. I assume those are coming from Richard.
Do you want to go first? Okay, thank you. Well, I'm not sure there's much more to be said. I'm not sure what I should say, but I do know that I should say thank you, first of all, to you in the audience. Thank you to the staffs of both organizations. Thank you particularly to Kui Bo for all his outstanding efforts. Thanks to all the participants, particularly those who came from further away than Bethesda or Fairfax, Virginia. I think this has been a really stimulating conference and some really rich presentations. I think we've done a good job in assessing the state and prospects for cross-strait relations in a fast-moving and fast-changing East Asian environment. Thanks. Okay. Do you want to say?
So maybe my last word. The Association for Relations was newly established last December, aimed at promoting Taiwan's external relations with all possible parties in the world. So this is our very first big event outside Taiwan, and hopefully in the future we can get more resources and have more similar conferences here either in Washington, D.C. or in some other major countries. Thank you very much.
The conference is adjourned.